Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Around here there shall surely be, born to be strong, raised to be free.
Graphic Audio presents Kelvin of Rudd. Narrated by Dylan Lynch. Performed by Michael John Casey, David Harris, Joel David Santner, Margie Tompros, Colleen Delaney, Michael Glenn, Thomas Penny, Stephen Carpenter, David Coyne, Elizabeth Jernigan, Alyssa Wilmoth, Nanette Savard, Katie Carcuff, James Lewis, Tim Getman, Eric Messner, Thomas Keegan, Daniel Sontag, Terrence Aselford, Patrick Bussing, Drew Copus, Nick DePinto, Christopher Graybill, Bradley Smith, Gary Tells, Kimberly Gilbert. Kelvin of Rudd, Book 1, Dragon's Gold.
The fugitive did not know that his arrival at the small Rudd farm was preordained. He would have scoffed at the notion had he been told. All he knew was that his injured leg hurt abominably, that he was so filthy, he was disgusted, and that he was too tired to fight or flee if discovered. It was night again. He had hardly been aware of the passage of time since his escape, except for the awful sun by day and the cruel chill by night. Yet this was a decent region, he knew, if viewed objectively. Apple berries and razzle fruits perfumed the air and set his stomach growling. Hunger. There was another curse of the moment. The thought of food had to be pushed aside, as did dreams of a hot bath and a change of clothing. He had come here to steal a horse. He hated the necessity, for he regarded himself as an honorable man, but he seemed to have no choice. He crept nearer to the cottage, orienting on its single faint light. He paused, studying the light. His pursuers had lost the trail last night, and he doubted that they would swim the river to pick it up again. There were hazards in that water as bad for guardsmen as for thieves, and only a truly desperate man would have been fool enough to risk it. Perhaps the guardsmen thought him dead already. This fool, for the time being, was almost safe. He came close and peered cautiously in the window. A slender girl sat reading by the flickering light of a lamp. He gazed at the coppery sheen of her hair, and the plain though somewhat pointed face, and the gentle swell and ebb of her bosom as she breathed. How lovely she seemed. It was not that she was beautiful, for by his standards she was not, but that she was comfortable and quiet and clean. A girl who read alone at night. What a contrast to the type of woman he had known. There was an aura of decency about her that excited his longing. He could love such a girl and such a lifestyle, if ever given a chance. For a moment, he was crazily tempted to knock on the window, to announce himself, to say,
"Hello there, young woman. Are you in need of a man? Give me a bath and some food, and I shall be yours forever."
But he was not yet so tired that no reason remained. If he did that, she would start up and scream, and the guardsman would come, and it would be over. He ducked past the window and tiptoed to the barn. From inside came the scent of horse and hay. He felt around in the dark just past the door and found the halter exactly where it should be. The arrangements in good Rudd barns were standard.
What?
She stood there in the wan light of the window, garbed in a filmy nightdress and a shawl. The first thing he noticed was the way her firm, slim leg showed in gauzy silhouette. The second thing he noticed was the pitchfork she held at waist height, aimed at his chest.
"Speak! What is your business here?"
"I came to steal your horse. I would rather have stolen your heart."
And what had possessed him to say that?
"You are a thief? A highwayman?"
"I'm not an ordinary thief, not even a good one, as you can see. I just had to have a horse. I know you won't believe that I'm not a criminal.
Why didn't you come openly to my door then?
I looked in your window and saw you reading. You were so nice. I thought you would scream if you saw me. I'm a fugitive from the Queen's dungeon. I know that doesn't make me a hero, but maybe it carries a bit of weight.
You have round ears. You cannot be of this planet. Certainly you are no ordinary thief. Introduce yourself, round ear.
John Knight, of Earth.
A name may be an omen. Knight?
She smiled a mysterious witching smile and lowered the fork.
You may call me Charlene. We shall be married on the morrow.
He stared at her. Then, tentatively, he smiled. She returned the smile. She took him inside the house and gave him a bath and some food, and when he was clean and fed, she kissed him and took him to her bed. He was so tired that he fell almost instantly to sleep, despite the presence of her warm body beside him. He didn't even care that this might be a ruse to lull him, so that she could safely turn him into the Queen's guardsman. He had to believe in her. Thus did John Knight first encounter the woman he was to marry. She practiced fortune-telling, so had known he was coming. A round-eared man who was a fugitive from the Queen. She had told no one of this vision, so knew that his arrival was no trap by the Queen. She had known that the man would be completely unprepossessing, but would be the one she could truly love, and that though he had known a woman before her, he would never know one after her. They married on the morrow in a secret ceremony, and that evening he was enough recovered to remain awake in her bed for some time. Their life together had begun abruptly, but had an unspoken understanding that was at times mysterious and at other times thoroughly natural to him. The following year, their round-eared baby was born, and 2 years after that, their point-eared baby. The prophecy that John Knight had not known about was on its way to fulfillment. His life was relatively placid after he settled, not so that of his children. The road wound like a twisting dragon's tail through rank underbrush and skeletal trees, past boulders the size of cottages, along a sparkling mountain stream bordered with high piles of debris left by the late spring floods. It did not look like the setting for the beginning of the fulfillment of a long-term prophecy. Two slim figures walked the road, carrying travel sacks and leading a donkey. One was 16, tall enough to be handsome were it not for his round ears. The other was 14, but looked 12 with pointed ears. Both wore the garb of rustics, heavy leather walking boots, brown berry shirts, greenbrier pantaloons, and lightweight summer stuckle caps, whose long tips ended in tassels of blue and green yarn. They could hardly have looked less like folk destined to commence the fulfillment of a significant prophecy. Kelvin, the older one, played on his mandajo as he walked, picking out the accompaniment to Fortune Come A-Callin', a Rudd tune of great antiquity. His thoughts were far away. John, the younger one, brushed back long yellow hair. A stranger, looking at John's alert greenish eyes and large ears and face that showed no hint of a beard, would have dismissed this as a lively boy. The stranger would have been mistaken. For John was Kelvin's sister. Because it could be dangerous for a girl to go alone into the countryside of Rudd, the parents had tried to restrict her to the farm and village. But John was an adventurous sort, always eager to go out exploring. Realizing that she could not be restrained, they had finally yielded with two stern strictures: always go in company with Kelvin and go as a boy. That suited John just fine, for though she would die rather than say it, she looked up to her brother and wanted to share his activities. She also rather liked masquerading as a boy, for though her parents had been happy to have a girl, John herself envied the freedoms and prospects of the other sex. She had become almost letter perfect at the masquerade, but now nature was playing on her a disgusting trick. Her hips were broadening and her breasts were swelling. It was getting harder to look the part, and it would be impossible without her solid shirt. What would she do when her rebellious front became too pronounced to conceal? She was disgusted, and the very thought put her in a bad mood. Now John peered into the underbrush and up into the branches of the trees, looking for trouble. She carried a sturdy leather sling, whose pocket held a carefully positioned rock of the required squirbit braining size. Just let one of those creatures show its snoot now.
Fortune come a-callin', but I did hide away. Hey! Fortune come a-callin', but I did ride bloody saber at my side away. Away.
You call that old pig got you packing a saber?
Kelvin lowered his instrument. His thoughts leaped ahead to the deepening gloom and the forbidding mountain pass.
We're not riding either.
He was referring to another verse.
No, but we would be if you hadn't let that horse dealer swindle us. A horse to ride would be great, but you jackass, you had to buy a jackass.
I thought that I could put two of them to work. You and Mockery.
Mockery's the name for it. Anyone but you would have been put off by the name. But you had to go and hand over our last two rudners for it.
John, show faith in thy elder. We hadn't the money for a horse, and Mockery was cheap. We'll need his strong back and yours to pack out all the gold we'll find.
If he even lets us load. It took us half the morning to get a pitiful few supplies strapped to his ornery back. He's got a kick like a mule. I suppose when we want our tent, he'll start all over.
Not so, little brother worrisome wart. It's only that he's jealous. We have the lighter loads. Smart animal, Mockery. Smart enough to know when we're in dragon country. Anything that smart, including me and possibly ye, knows the danger.
Do we, Kel?
Kelvin narrowed the bluish eyes that seemed almost as strange as his rounded ears in Rudd. This was not like John. Usually, she tried with pretty good success to appear more recklessly masculine than any ordinary boy could be. Until today, she had seemed, if anything, too confident. What was bothering her?
John, if you're afraid...
Ain't that. Not any more than you are, anyway. But curse it, Kel, if I'm going to get ate up by a dragon, at least I want a chance.
Few people have a chance. Dragons are big and strong and mean. If you run into one, it will devour you fast. Once it bites off your head, which I'm sure it will do early on, I can promise you that you will hardly feel a thing.
Great. So just stay away from it?
That's all anyone with any sense does. Or anything with sense.
But dragons have been killed, haven't they?
A few times by heroes with armor and war horses and lances. You know that, John. A few have fallen, but not to the likes of us.
But if we had a good sword and a war horse and a lance...
We'd get it just the same. You ever see me ride a war horse? Or use a sword except for hacking brush? It takes training, John. It doesn't just happen.
John subsided into silence as they plodded on. The road was becoming narrower with every mile. The debris piles were getting higher and higher. The sun hid its face behind the peak of the mountain to the west.
I don't like this place. It's ugly.
Nobody comes here for a picnic, John. Riches aren't found in the nicest places. If we're to get gold, we have to put up with ugliness.
Kelvin estimated the time. It was getting to be late in the afternoon. Soon they would stop to build camp, and then early tomorrow they'd find gold. Or at least they'd search for it. If the spring floods had washed it down from the high mountains, they might find nuggets of it along the stream. That was their hope. That was what made this an adventure instead of just a chance to explore. A chance for John to be a boy. Perhaps one of the last chances, for soon there would be no easy way to conceal her nature.
Gods, Kel! Look what I found!
Kelvin blinked as he strained his sight to see what shone so brightly in John's hands. His eyes were not the best. If John's curse was being a girl, his own was being inadequate in various ways like this. John had reached down into a clump of ugly brown weeds and now held something that filled her cupped palms. Carefully, Kelvin took it from her, bringing it close enough for a decent focus. It was a scale that could have come from a dragon's neck. It had the heft of gold and some luster through the grime. It could be very valuable.
It's a dragon scale, isn't it? Isn't it?
Easy, John, easy. Don't shout or do anything to attract a dragon's attention. This could be fresh and...
Think I'm crazy? It is, isn't it? Gold that migrated to the scale from the nugget swallowed by the dragon? Oh, it's just like the book said. Just like shellfish, they get metal in their shells from ingesting bits of metal and then become unfit to eat. We're lucky. Oh, so lucky!
Quiet, fool! The dragon could be in hearing distance.
Around here? If that's so, why isn't smart-ass Mockery a-rearing and a-raring and kicking up his heels? You know dragons shed scales. Well, it probably happened weeks ago.
Yes, but we can't be sure. We can't be sure it's not lurking and waiting for us.
Ha! You think it was just dropped?
John pointed to a pile of dried dragon dung. Calvin looked at the bits of white bone sticking out of the dung.
We have to be careful, John. We have to check around here to make sure there's no fresh sign. If a dragon's been around in the last day or so, we want to move out. If we don't find fresh sign, we'll set up the tent, cook the squirbit you bagged, eat, and get a good night's sleep. Then, first thing tomorrow, we'll search.
His hands felt clammy as he put the scale into a pocket of his pantaloons. The very notion of a nearby dragon gave him the cold sweats. But John was already climbing a high mountain of rocks and weeds and piled up tree trunks. As usual, she did not appear to have heard a word Calvin said. Controlling his feelings as much as he could, Calvin petted Mockery and made plans for putting up the tent and cooking the squirbit John had knocked over earlier during the day. He took off Mockery's pack, put hobbles on the beast, went to the nearest sapling and cut a sturdy tent pole with his incredibly dull sword.
I found another! Oh, two more! Kill the six of them! All in a bunch! And stained! The dragon must have been in a fight with another dragon!
So that was why so many downed trees. The flooding river hadn't done it. Dragons had added to the carnage of this region. He shivered in spite of himself as he imagined the size of the beasts. Two of them? That would account for the ground being grassless over there and for the dirt showing. Where would the loser go afterward?
Let's make our camp now, John! Please!
John ignored him, clambering nimbly on up the rock pile. She had no foolish concern about monsters. He picked at a blister on his hand as he waited for her to finish with the pile and come down.
Kel! I found!
Kelvin spotted her atop a jumble of boulders piled amidst tree trunks, the rock coated with decomposed vegetation and sandy soil from the river bottom.
Kel! I see! I think I see the dragon!
What?!
The dragon! I think it's dead! Oh, it's dead, Kel! It's got licked in a fight! All those scales! Oh, we'll reach, Kel! Come on up and...
What is it, John?
Oh, Kel, it's alive! Oh, but it's almost dead, I think! I think we can kill it and...
John, come away from there!
A fortune, Kel, a fortune! Oh, Kel, I'm gonna sling a rock at it!
No! No, John, no rock!
But the intrepid little sister was already twirling her sling. With the skill of long practice and a natural knack, she let fly.
Got him!
Kelvin couldn't speak. His horror had closed off his throat entirely. He held his breath as John stared down the opposite side of the pile. What was she seeing there, anyway?
It sees me, Kel! It's awake! Kel, it's coming for me!
Run, John, run! Back here!
John's head appeared at the crest. Now it came to him. This huge pile of debris had been kicked up by the fighting dragons. Fighting? Then why wasn't the loser dead? A dragon never left prey or an enemy alive. He would chew it to bits just out of spite, even if he wasn't hungry. Dragons like to kill, to make blood splatter. Everyone knew that. When they fought each other, the loser always died because no dragon ever fled from anything. It couldn't have been a fight. Then what had happened? Obviously, this dragon had been only sleeping. But why had it scratched up such a mountain of refuse? For he was sure now, the natural hill here had been enhanced by more than flood refuse. Dragons were known to be as lazy as any other creature. They saved their energy for important things, like pursuing prey and fighting and mating. He remembered the stories now. The mating of dragons was almost indistinguishable from a fight to the death. It seemed that the females never did mate voluntarily, so the males had to run them down and subdue them and rape them. It was said that the effort of doing this tired out a male dragon more than any other activity, and that some dropped into deep sleep on the spot. That must have been the case with this one. Probably it would have slept for several more hours if John hadn't jolted him with a rock on the snoot. John was coming down the ragged slope, slip-sliding across slime-slick stones. The dragons probably hadn't even noticed the havoc they wrought on the landscape. The male had finally tamed the female, probably holding her down with his huge teeth and claws while it rammed into her torso. There would be blood galore, his as well as hers. Once the male's urge was spent, his grip would have relaxed and the female would have torn free and departed. John turned and dropped, sliding through loosely piled debris and riverborne brush. She had fallen into a hole in the pile. Huge claws dug at smooth rock to find a foothold. Kelvin looked wildly about for safety, spotted none, and turned to his faithful steed. The donkey, amazingly enough, was chomping grass. Obviously, the animal was stone deaf. This was the first time Kelvin had realized it.
Kel! Kel, he's going to get me! Kel, he's going to get me! He's climbing up! Kel, he's climbing!
What does one do when one's sister is in dire danger from a menace that cannot be opposed? One does what little one can. Raising the old sword in his already sore hand, Kelvin rushed madly for the pile. A tree trunk lay next to some smaller rocks and made a regular staircase that John had followed. Kelvin's running feet found it of their own accord. He reached the spot where John had fallen, looked down between stacked rocks and tree trunks, and saw her frightened face.
Kel, I can't get out in time! I'm trapped! Save yourself, Kel! Save yourself!
Kelvin, in a rear portion of his mind, recognized this as one of his sister's better ideas, but somehow he wasn't satisfied with it. Whether he would have taken her up on it, he could never afterward be certain. For at that moment, the golden-scaled, elongated snout of the dragon appeared over the pile's top boulder. The thing was simultaneously awful and beautiful. Deadly living gold. He had known that dragons were monstrous, but from this range, that was an appalling understatement. He judged that this one could swallow both of them in a single gulp. He could not see the main torso, but guessed that its size must be equivalent to that of 6 or 7 large war horses. The monster levered itself up on gigantic scaled claws. Its entire head was now visible, and the front of its body. Kelvin could see the crest on the head and the short leathery wings. He knew he should be afraid, but his emotions seemed to have shorted out that stage, leaving him strangely clear-headed. Kelvin raised his sword. His arm shook so that he seemed to be fencing. He wished he had scoured off the rust and put a razor edge on the blade. He couldn't imagine what he could do with a sharp, clean sword, let alone this dull, dirty one. But now was not a good time for imagination anyway. His arm went numb. Something serpentine and leathery and wet curled 3 times around his sword blade and 2 around his wrist. He lurched backward in horror and was promptly pulled forward by the long forked tongue.
Oh, some sword!
Kelvin was insanely hacking with the edge of his free hand at the tongue's forked tip. The dragon seemed unaffected by the hand chops that had all but fractured Kelvin's good right arm. He got to his feet, wedged in a crack of a boulder, and pushed back. The tongue uncurled from his arm and the sword went with it, up and into the cavernous mouth. Those teeth! They were the size of short swords, the breath a poisonous hot wind from a fetid swamp. Then he saw the sword spinning in midair. The dragon had simply spit out Kelvin's best and only weapon, and now the ground closed in about him. He was falling through the same hole that had swallowed John. His arms spread out reflexively to catch hold of the edges, but his fingers only tore out hunks of brush and sand. His descent slowed, but did not stop. It was dark in this hole and smelly.
Are you hurt?
Just bruised. You?
Could the beast move the boulders? Could it dig them out? How tired was it?
Kel!
Quiet!
There's a hole here.
Kelvin felt John's hand in the dark, and she moved it to the place. There was indeed a hole, an aperture formed by 2 large tree limbs near ground level. A way out, possibly. But not necessarily to safety. If the dragon discovered it, he could reach in with that long tongue and lick them out as if they were only ants. This hole was more danger than help. Kelvin tried to think of a way to seal off the opening and keep the dragon's sinuous tongue outside. His hands went out in quick desperation and snagged on a broken branch. He felt along the branch and encountered a smooth, rounded surface. Further investigation informed his senses that there was a boulder that wasn't supporting anything. If he and John could somehow move it and use it as a plug for the hole.
Look!
In the dim light, he saw the dragon's clawed foot, just as it lit on something.
There goes Mercury!
Kelvin had an ugly picture of the donkey in the jaws of the dragon, and he hoped the monster would hurt his teeth on the hobbles. Mercury was unable to run. If only he hadn't put those restraints on. But he realized that this just might have saved his life and John's. The dragon had found easier prey. Suddenly, Kelvin realized that his sister was worming on past him, blocking his light.
What? What, John?
I won't let it! I won't let it! It can't have Mercury! Mercury's ours!
Kelvin grabbed hold of a slim leg above and below a boot top and pulled her back.
You want the dragon to discover this hole?
John subsided. Kelvin breathed a silent sigh. Now, if the incipient scream of the donkey didn't set her off...
Oh, hey, what the...
He felt a foot on his back.
Oh, there's a root here. There's something. I think I can get back up.
The dragon had moved. Now he could see the little donkey hobbled near the riverbank. It no longer mattered whether Mercury could hear. Certainly, he could see and smell. The donkey's eyes were rolled back. The nostrils flared. The dragon's awful golden-scaled head moved directly over the animal. Slowly, the long serpentine neck lowered, hunching, and the mouth gaped to display the deadly teeth. The forked tongue shot from the mouth and just touched the donkey's flank. It was a magnificent donkey kick that landed with stunning accuracy on the huge snout. The dragon didn't even seem to notice. Seemingly bent on tasting before devouring, it closed its front teeth in a dreadful snap on Mockery's tail. Kelvin closed his eyes, dreading what the dragon would do next. There was nothing he could do except let it happen.
Bite my ass, will you? Take that!
Kelvin's eyes popped open as the childish scream of defiance ended and a walnut-sized projectile struck the dragon's blood-red eye. The neck twisted the head around to stare at the pile of debris and at the small human figure. A great claw lifted to the lizard face and delicately flicked out the rock from beneath the eye's lid. The dragon went back in striking position.
This is the end of John!
Then John jumped down into the hole, landing on him.
Got him, Kel! Got him right in the eye, right in the big bloody eyeball!
You've gotten us killed! That thing might have been content with the donkey, but now...
A huge open nostril was sucking up dust at the ground-level hole. Certainly the dragon smelled him now.
John, help me roll this boulder!
Kelvin strained at the rock, trying to get it between them and the flaring nostril. He strained, and then he remembered a broken branch he had felt before that might serve as a pry, and a smaller rock that might serve as a fulcrum. Quickly, he got the smaller rock and the branch positioned, and got John's small hands on the branch next to his.
Heave, John, heave!
The rock quivered ever so slightly. It was free, broken free of the dirt. Now, if it would just move.
Kel, it's got me!
At that moment, Kelvin realized that a rough and living rope had shot to the side of the boulder and fastened on John.
Where does he have you?
My leg!
Hang on to me! I think...
He threw his back into the lever and then all his weight, buttressed by hers. The dragon was pulling her, and that was actually helping them to put pressure on the lever. The boulder moved. Kelvin scraped up a bit more strength from somewhere and put all he had into it. The boulder rolled grudgingly over the soggy ground. Now, if only... It had. The boulder had partially blocked the hole and...
I'm free, Kel! He let go, but...
Something moved next to Kelvin's shoulder. The dragon's long tongue was under the heavy boulder. A rock the weight of perhaps two very large men or one very small donkey. The tongue was pinned. The tongue vibrated at its unpinned tip. Saliva rained into their enclosure.
We got him, John! For now, let's get out of here before he forgets how he's hurting and starts using his legs to roll that rock off his tongue!
For though the dragon could readily have moved the rock with its legs or even its head, it was too stupid to make that connection. It was trying to free its tongue by reflex, snatching it back into its mouth. That way would never work. John led the way. They helped each other out of the trap and to the top of the pile where John had first sighted the dragon. The beast lay almost level with their faces, its eyes glaring hatred. Kelvin stared back, almost hypnotized by the stare. John picked up the fallen sword and handed it to him.
You've got to kill. If you don't, it may get loose. Or it could just die here.
Kelvin took the old sword, held it tight, and considered the best place to attack. An eye? Probably. But would the sword penetrate all the way to the beast's brain? A large clawed foot came up as he hesitated, striking within an arm's length of John. The sword was inadequate, Kelvin concluded. He needed a lance.
John, that long tent pole I cut, can you bring it to me?
What do you want it for?
Just get it, hurry!
From the corner of his eye, he watched her scamper. He stood just outside the range of the monster's leg. It was unnerving to be this close, but if he retreated farther, he would not be in position to strike at the eye if that became necessary. John paused to examine Mockery's tail stump.
John! John! John!
Finally, she brought the pole. He used the sword to sharpen the end of the pole to a near needle point. The dragon's eye watched him with unnerving intensity. It would be better if he could fasten the sword to the pole, but then there was a haft on the sword that would surely stop it from penetrating. The pole, if he put his weight behind it, would stab through the jelly of the eyeball and on through into the pulsing, seething brain. Suddenly, Kelvin felt faint. The vision of that brain. Could he do it, even to save his own life? Could he kill so messily in such cold blood? John watched as he put down the sword. Her face wore a peculiar and undefinable expression.
Kel, let me do it!
No! It's dangerous, and I doubt you're strong enough. I'm not even sure that I'm strong enough.
That's what I'm afraid of. You look as if you're about to conk out.
No!
Kelvin took the pole firmly in his hands, balanced it until it felt right, and ran the few steps to the dragon. Staring into the blood-red eye and trying to visualize the location of the brain in that reptilian head, he drove the pointed stake with all his strength. The point hit true. The eye was so large that it would have been difficult to miss. It went through the pupil, sending blood and gray stuff squirting back at him. The dragon's head jerked violently. The pole snapped up into the air, hauling Kelvin with it, and he flew. He had a glimpse of Mockery and the river and trees. There was the sensation of air moving across his face. He knew he had done all he could. Had it been enough, he felt only a timeless waiting as for unknown hands.
Mama, why are my ears so small and so round? Why aren't they like yours? Why are they like Daddy's?
Kelvin sat in the bath and put questions to his beautiful mother. Even as a small child, he knew what a lovely creature she was. Her hair was the hue of copper, and her eyes of violets. Her skin was translucently white, and her ears were large and pointed. What more could a child ask for?
Because, my dear, you are very special.
Special, Mama?
Your father is special. That is why you are, too.
But why?
He's from another world, dear. A world just a little bit different from ours. There are many such worlds, many such existences, universes. They lie side by side, touching as the skins touch on an onlick. Each skin subtly different, yet subtly the same. We can't see the worlds that interpenetrate ours, but they are there. And they are real to the people or beings living there.
There?
Here, all about us. Your father talks of atoms and the great spaces between the stars, but the wise ones in our world have different explanations.
Here? Another boy? Another boy in another world in another tub?
Perhaps many boys in many vessels on many worlds, touching and almost a part of ours. It has to be. That may be how myths start, and superstitions, and stories and tales from the imagination. It's the closeness, the nearness, the very near identity. You'll understand when you're older, dear. When you're old enough to begin to fulfill the prophecy.
prophecy. What's that, Mama?
She dried her hands on a towel, crossed the room to his father's desk, opened it, and took out the vellum-covered book with a blood stain on its cover. She brought it to him, opened it, and turned the pages so he could see the strange, straggly letters.
This is the Book of Prophecy. It was written long, long ago by Muva the Magnificent, who saw ahead, and who wrote ahead, and who became godlike in the process. Muva, who fought the great battle with the dark sorcerer Zatanas, and who will live, some say, forever if Zatanas does not finally kill him and eject his essence from our continuum. I'm going to read to you some of Muvar's words written long, long before your father and I were born.
Is it about me, Mama?
Yes, darling. It's about you. It's in rhyme, like all the prophecies. It doesn't give your name, but it's about you. A round ear there shall surely be, born to be strong, raised to be free, fighting dragons in his youth, leading armies, nothing loath, ridding his country of a sore, joining two, then uniting four, until from seven there be one, only then will his task be done. Honored by many, cursed by few, all will know what Round Ear can do.
That's pretty, Mama. What does it mean?
That you will fight dragons. That you will rid Rudd of its tyrant queen, Zoanna, daughter of Zatanas. That you will first join two of the seven kingdoms, then unite with four. That you will finally join and unite into one land, all the seven kingdoms.
How will I do that, Mama?
When the time comes, you'll find a way. It's prophecy. Prophecy may be misunderstood, but it always comes true. Always. If not in our world, in another almost like it.
True about dragons, too?
Yes, darling. About dragons, too.
Dragons? With claws and teeth and a long tongue and scales?
Yes, darling. And the scales will be gold. Just as in the story I read to you.
And will I marry the princess? And will we live happily together ever after in a great big palace? Will we have servants and courtiers and jesters and acrobats and ponies?
You may, but the prophecy leaves us to guess about such details. I don't have the complete prophecy. No one does. Bits of it are scattered around the globe. Some talk of gloves and some of round-eared girls. But those may not be valid aspects of it. But I know enough to know that you are the one.
Did you know all the details when you married Daddy?
I hardly knew any, dear. I simply knew that I had to marry a round ear if I was to have a round ear child. And even then the chances were only even. I hoped he would be a good man.
You wanted a round ear son?
I did indeed, Kelvin. But had I known he would be you, I would have wanted him even without the prophecy.
His father finished twirling the rope and tossed it over the peg. A jerk of the line and the peg shot from the ground and followed the rope to his hands.
All right, Kelvin. Now you try.
It's magic, Daddy! It's magic!
It's not magic. Magic is simply natural law that hasn't been explained. There's no such thing as magic in this world or any other. Do you understand?
Yes, Father.
Kelvin watched the adult round ear, frightened as the lasso was placed in his hands.
Now you practice, and you practice, and you practice. This is the only skill I had before I went into the army, and it's the only skill I can leave you with.
What good is it, Father?
You saw me lasso the cow the other day.
Yes, but she would have come anyway.
Someday there may be something that won't. Now you hold the loop in this hand, and...
They worked at it for a very long time, but finally he could rope the peg nearly as well as could his father. The door flew open, scaring Kelvin as he played with fortune cards on the cottage floor. His father rushed in, trailing a cold wind and a swirl of snow. He limped across the room, favoring the leg the wild bull had kicked long ago while he was trying to separate it from their cow. Mama looked up from the coat she was mending, her expression the one she wore when she was expecting something to happen that happened.
Charlene, I saw them again. They tracked the rumors to the village. Now I have to go. I won't endanger you and the boy any longer.
Your travel sack is ready. Will you take the horse?
I can't take your horse. I couldn't take it the first time I came here, and I can't do it now. You'll need it for plowing. Those cursed tax collectors.
I'll fix you a lunch.
Calvin looked at his father, and together they watched his mother go into the kitchen. Suddenly, his father was kneeling by him, holding him up against his chest.
Don't cry, Father!
Son, I want you to listen. Listen to me now, even if you never have before. Your mother's head is filled with nonsense. Don't believe her, son. In my world, they understand about atoms and the spaces between atoms. That prophecy is nonsense. It's foolish. I'm just a boy, son. You won't have to fight a dragon and fight with a sword and lead armies the way she says. If I can, I'll come for you someday. All three of you. If we can, we'll go home to my world. It's not as nice as this world in some ways, but then in other ways...
Father!
It will be, son. It must be. Promise me you won't try to live out her prophecies. She's a fine woman, but...
Here's your lunch.
She held out a small packet that gave forth the smell of freshly baked bread and a jar of the bright red razzle fruit wine that Calvin was not yet allowed to try.
Charlene!
Then the two were hugging as though there was never to be any more of it.
I don't want to go. I really don't, but...
It might as well have been written. It's as true that you have to as the prophecy itself.
Yes. But we both know I don't believe in that nonsense.
Calvin, you stay inside and keep an eye on your sister. Play with your cards. Read your fortune, and your father's, and mine. I'll come back to you before it is supper time.
Calvin watched them out of the house and into the barn where the horse was kept. When they did not immediately emerge, he did what his mother had told him and sat down with the cards. His sister, only 2 years old, was sleeping, so she was no trouble. He looked at the painted pictures and swirling symbols on the cards. Could these tell anything about what the future would bring?
Sometimes, if you look at them and think about them.
Nonsense, nonsense, all of it nonsense. Don't you believe her?
But Mommy had countered Daddy with a conspiratorial wink. She knew what she knew, however tolerant she was of the ignorance of others. The woodsman's face was grim when he brought the news. Watching him and his mother, Calvin felt that she really didn't look surprised. She looked, in fact, much as she had the day his father left.
Nothing much to bury, ma'am. They cut the big bits into little bits, the filthy highwaymen, whoever did it. The wild things had been feasting, but it was no wild thing that was to blame.
I dreamed it would be you, Hal Hackleberry. You to bring me the dread news and more.
Ma'am?
Charlene. I want it to be Charlene again.
She picked up a stockle cap that his father had sometimes worn under protest, patting it as though it were alive. She looked at what she was doing, then back at the woodsman.
He didn't believe. Never once. Even after Calvin happened. He just wouldn't believe.
I understand, ma'am. Some men are like that. It's nothing against them, you understand?
I know. Not against them. Some things just have to be. Would you care for some wine?
Why, yes, ma'am. I would, but...
But I have already grieved. I knew when he left that I would never see him again in this life. I grieved, and now... Now I am ready.
Ma'am?
For a new life. A life that maybe was only interrupted for a time.
Calvin was surprised to find tears dripping from his face. The woodsman might be a good man, but Daddy was special. John and Calvin had been working beside Hal, their replacement father, grubbing out some tree stumps so that they could plant more grain. The sound warned of the approach of guardsmen. Hal nodded toward the woods.
Better you get out of sight, Kel, just in case.
I'll go with him.
Maybe that's best. You're growing up, girl, and there's no telling what guardsmen might do.
John flushed, hating to be reminded of her nature, but it was true. The Queen's guardsmen had been known to do things to young girls that couldn't be done to boys. That might be part of what she hated about being a girl. They went behind some duckberry bushes and crouched. Shortly, the guardsmen were there on their war horses, talking down to Hal.
Behind on your taxes, farmer.
It's been a bad year.
You pay a fine. A big fine.
I'll get the money. But if I sell our horse, there'll be no money to buy more seed grain.
That's your worry, farmer. Scum like you have to pay. If you don't pay, we set fire to your house and seize your boy to sell in the boy market.
I'll pay. I just have to chop some wood and...
But the big guardsman's face was turning redder and then golden in the rays of the sun. Squinting through the bushes, Kelvin began to see him with a snout like that of a dragon. What was the big difference between a guardsman and a dragon? Both brought destruction on common folk. The matter of dragons was looming larger in Kelvin's mind. He feared them terribly, but their scales were gold and represented wealth that could free the farm of debt. He would really have to do what he had talked about to John. They would have to leave here and go after gold.
John!
The girl looked up at him with eyes that shone from her face nearly as brightly as what she held in her bloody hands. What she held was palm-sized yellow gold that had belonged to the late dragon.
Gee, Kel, I thought you were dead!
So you were getting the gold anyway?
Well, I couldn't reach you very well, and I thought I might as well start getting the scales. Well, they come off hard, Kel. It's going to be a lot of work.
Kelvin wormed his way off the tree branch, held himself poised, then swung clear and dropped.
I looked about some. There's a funny little patch of berries.
You didn't eat strange berries. You know that many of the wild plants out here are poisonous?
Of course I know. I can't charm them into edibility the way you can, with your round ears. I didn't eat any, but for all I know, they might be good, so I saved a few to show Mommy.
Kelvin relaxed. At least she had had some sense.
But what's strange is that they look, well, tended, almost as if the dragon was taking care of them. His prints are all around the patch, and there's a path leading to it, which is how I found it. A dragon path. I was going off to, you know.
She never liked to refer directly to natural functions, partly because she couldn't perform them in quite the manner she deemed proper for a boy.
So I followed this path, because it was easy, and there was this patch, almost like a garden, and the dragon could have tromped all over it, but didn't. Well, isn't that funny?
You did right to save some. Dragons know about some things we don't.
Feeling trembly and far from good, he let his legs collapse beneath him. He sat down on the flat area between two short wings. The dragon's tongue was still protruding from its mouth and entering the debris hole, but now a long pole was embedded in its left eye socket. Evidently, he had scored on the brain, but he shivered to think how close a call it had been. If he had not thrust hard enough, or if the dragon's death throes had hurled him into the trunk of a tree instead of onto a branch, could he really have a charmed life, the way his mother insisted? She had been right about his magic with plants, after all, and if he really was destined to be the hero of the prophecy, then this was not the coincidence it seemed. Yet his father had been such a practical man, making so much sense, that it was hard to believe he could have been wrong about magic.
You get him off, Kel. It's far too much work.
For you, you mean?
Nuh-uh. You're the biggest, so...
Then her composure disintegrated. She flung herself into his arms, almost stabbing him with the sword.
Oh, Kel, I thought you were dead. Maybe. And I couldn't even reach you.
So it had all been an act, her nonchalance. Unable to help him, she had gotten to work, hoping he would recover. And when he had, she tried to remain tough, but wasn't able to carry it quite all the way through. How glad he was of that. She had almost fooled him. In a moment, she recovered her composure.
No, I'm getting all icky. I'm sorry.
I'm not. Do you think I like the notion that you don't care at all what happens to me?
But it's not manly to cry.
John, someday you're gonna have to accept the fact that you're not...
Oh, shut up!
Anyway, I'd sure cry if you got killed. But you're right. We've got to get to work here. There's a skinning knife in the pack. I'll use that, and you use the sword, and with luck, we'll get the job done.
When?
Before nightfall, if you work hard. You're not gonna be girlishly squeamish about dirty work, are you?
No!
I thought not. Here, let me see how it works.
Kelvin took the sword from her, stuck it under the nearest scale, and pried. Grudgingly, it came up. Then he cut at the leathery flesh holding it. This would take longer than nightfall, he realized. Even a dead dragon was tough. He hacked the scale free and held it up.
There we are. Easy as pie.
Kelvin returned the sword to John and went to fetch the knife. He was correct. 3 grueling days later, they had finished as much of the unpleasant task as was possible without turning over the dragon, and were on their way out of the pass. It was just as well, for the huge carcass was decomposing, and the vultures were circling ever lower. Soon, the attention of other predators or even men would be attracted, and that would be no good for the 2 treasure hunters. They had to get away with their prize and back to the farm, unobserved. Bobtailed Mockery was in tow with 2 very heavy travel sacks. They had scraped the scales as clean of attached flesh as possible and washed them in the river, but still some odor accompanied them.
Do you think we should have dumped all our stuff? Those pans and those blankets were still good, even if Mockery did roll on them in the river.
We can buy more. 1 scale should buy all the pans and blankets we'll need in our entire lives.
If we don't live too long.
Of course, Brother Wart.
They were out of the pass now, and the sun was shining, and it looked to be a glorious day for 2 rich youngsters. Kelvin was thinking that they hadn't much of a worry in the world. A few scales would pay off the errant taxes on the farm, and a few more would cover all the luxuries Charlene might want, and Hal too, though Hal was a man of simple tastes. They would turn the scales over to him for safekeeping. He was honest and would not cheat anyone. Suddenly, a huge black war horse appeared as if by magic in the road ahead. It bore a man clad all in black. He leveled a sword that flashed golden in the sun and looked extremely sharp.
Your property or your lives?
We're without coin.
No coin, just scale. What'd you 2 do, find a dead dragon?
No.
The man's sword tip slashed through the lashings on Mockery's pack and sent the sacks falling. Golden platelets came loose from their stacks and rained down. Kelvin choked. He grabbed his sword, yanked it from its scabbard, and watched as it spun through the air in response to the highwayman's quick and expert backhand motion.
Don't try that again, Sonny, or it's your life. You! Drop that sling or you eat your ears!
God's curse you, highway horse excrement!
You do what I say, cubwhelp!
John's sling started its defiant circle, but before she could let fly, the horseman had leaped his horse to within arm's reach and was leaning down, grabbing the girl by her shoulders. John's head tossed helplessly, and her long yellow hair flopped out of the cap. Then the highwayman thrust her aside.
You look like a damn girl. Maybe I'll just lop off some of that hair.
Bastard!
But appearances can be deceiving, eh? Spoken like a man you'll someday be. Both of you, load that scale back on the beast. Tie the strap together again so it holds, and hand your own packs up here.
They worked, Kelvin knowing that his own face must resemble John's. If only the outlaw would make some mistake. Finished, scales all in place on Mockery's and the war horse's broad backs. The bandit rode over to John. Leaning down, he grabbed the girl and swung her up in front of him in the saddle.
I'm taking this one to market. An overseer's whip will teach him some manners. Snarly whelp.
Suddenly, Kelvin leaped for the warhorse's bridle. He grabbed the rein and raised an arm to try to deflect a blow from the highwayman's sword. A moment later, he found himself lying in the partly filled ditch as a bird sang somewhere and the drumming of the warhorse's hooves pounded off in the distance. Once again, Kelvin had been absolutely ineffective. John had ceased struggling hours ago. She had realized very early that the more she resisted, the tighter the highwayman gripped her, and it would not be long before his hand or arm encountered aspects of her that were not normal for a boy.
Not so chipper now, little foul mouth. You know where I'm taking you. You know what's gonna happen to you.
You said the boy, Mark.
John knew of it. Runaway boys, delinquent boys, boys seized for their father's non-payment of taxes, possibly even kidnapped boys were sold like livestock to be slaves. To work someone's plantation or mine or to row a galley. It was all legal in Rudd, and boys remained slaves until they reached the legal age of manhood, 25. Quite a number, it was said, failed to live to that age. There was, however, one thing worse than the boy mart. That was the girl mart. The girls, it was said, generally lived out their terms, but hardly wanted to. The lucky ones became housemaids or servant girls, but many were sold to brothels or to sadistic old men. Suicide was the leading cause of death among them. Already John knew that if she didn't manage to escape, she had better protect her secret, because the boy mart was the better bet.
Yeah, the boy mart. Best thing in the world for you. It's the only thing in the world for you.
John looked around at the towering cliffs and the stunted trees and the new twisted path that led through brambles and brush and on into the bleak land. It was semi-desert ahead. That was what was called the Sadlands, a region fit only for scorpio crabs, giant spiders, and snakes. Outlaws such as this one reportedly lived there, though why they should choose to do so was a mystery. Well, perhaps not so big a mystery. Since honest folk stayed well clear of the Sadlands, that made it relatively safe for outlaws. If they had good horses, as this one did, they could range pretty far out, raiding better regions and returning.
Whoa!
John made her decision to fight, to the extent she was able without risking betraying her nature. Whatever the outlaw wanted, he was not going to get much cooperation. The bandit slipped a dark bandana over her face.
Can't have you seeing where we're going for the night, whelp.
So that was it. The outlaw was not very smart for telling her. One way or the other, she was going to see through the bandana, or over it, or around it. Since she was destined for the boy mart, she probably would not be hurt if she behaved. Then, when she escaped, she could tell Kelvin where the highwayman's hideout was, so they could steal back their gold. But the bandana was tight. Twice folded over her eyes, it let in not a bit of light. The outlaw, unfortunately, knew his business. The horse resumed its steady walk. She tried to edge a hand up to the bandana, but got it slapped down promptly.
Nah! None of that, I tell you!
But she had to see. She had to. An insect buzzed loudly near her left ear. She shook her head, and as she did, an idea struck. Her ears. She could wiggle her ears. Girls weren't supposed to do that, therefore it was one of her proudest accomplishments. If she could wiggle her ears just enough, the bandana just might be coaxed down a bit. The right side of the blindfold wasn't folded evenly at the top. If she could work the single thickness down, she could see through it, if the bandit didn't stop her. Slowly, John turned her head until her right ear was directed frontward. The outlaw might not see it now, with luck.
The fly is bothering you. Here. Oh, I missed the fly. Hit your face.
Had he seen? John wondered. Could she see now that the bandana had slipped a little? Through her right eye, she picked up a little light. She could make out the bright sunlight and its sheen on two towering rocks, one on either side of the horse. They were going a different way than into the Sadlands. This was back the way they had come. So the bandit was trying to deceive her. Now she detected the scent of the bilrose tree and remembered the grove they had passed through earlier. Then she heard water and knew they were back at the river. The horse was taking another road into the mountains. It was the only turnoff place near the river. John was certain because she had walked every step into Dragon Country. It went up above the village of Franklin, and then into the mountains, and then somewhere she had not been. They were up in the mountains, and John knew the road they had taken. The highwayman had said he didn't want her to see where they would spend the night, and now he seemed satisfied that she didn't know where they had gone. So the camp or cave or whatever must be close. How criminally clever to have a hideout close to a traveled road while pretending to stay far away.
Well, we're here!
With that, he pulled the blindfold off. John blinked. A rude log cabin was there, set in a box canyon. Cactus trees stood nearby. It could indeed be the edge of the mountains and the Sadlands. The outlaw expected her to think they had ridden on, and that this place was far away from where they had left Kelvin.
Murder! Murder! Come look what I brought!
A big, slovenly woman with a wart to the side of her large nose appeared in the doorway. She could almost be this outlaw's sister, judging by her looks. But the way the two embraced indicated otherwise.
Another boy? Can't you do better than that? There's a glut of them on the market. They don't fetch the prices they used to.
I did do better, woman. Take a look at these.
The man held out scales that still had some messy flesh attached, despite Kelvin's and her own best efforts.
Ugh! What?
Scale, love. Scale. This one and his brother found a dead dragon and pulled its scales off. They loaded them for me in those bags on the donkey and an ear.
A dead dragon?
Must have been. The pup and his weakling brother are still alive.
Some people have all the luck.
Yeah, us!
The highwayman shoved John stumbling to the back of the cabin. A rough cage stood there with open door. John knew better than to argue. She climbed inside the cage and watched him lock the door.
You shall bring you a few corn beans and a jug of water. You sleep on that old blanket in the corner and don't try to escape.
Suppose I do?
Well, then I'll slice your legs off and leave you for the wild hogcats and the beavers. And that's if I'm in a good mood. If I'm in a bad mood, I'll do something mean.